Hi, welcome back to Eye to Eye, a weekly podcast talk show about passion, flow, and creativity. So while the topics may change, the heart behind it remains the same. I'm your host, Erin Holman, and my guest today is...
Dr. Ashley Wellman.
Dr. Ashley Wellman, I'm happy you were able to join us today.
Thank you so much, Erin. I love your energy, and I cannot wait to contribute to the conversation.
Welcome to the podcast. This is, like I said, a show about passion, flow, and creativity, things that I know that you have a lot of. So, Dr. Wellman, you have a PhD in, I believe it's criminology in law society.
You're exactly right.
In your own words, just start off, tell us what are your preferred pronouns and more about yourself.
She, her, and hers. And I am, like you just said, I'm a scholar in the field of criminology. And so since 2011, that's when I got my PhD at the University of Florida, I have been working with the families of homicide. And so I actually did that during my graduate career. I worked with families who were impacted by a murder, particularly those who didn't have a solution in the case. So they became cold case homicide survivors. I will tell you later that came full circle for hope and inspiration and being able to provide me with strength that I didn't know was possible, because I was able to work and use my platform to help these families who were impacted by violent crime. And since I've also been able to help so many sexual assault survivors, both men and women, who have experienced trauma from a sexual assault. And so that's been my professional career. I've been blessed to be a professor at multiple institutions and work with some awesome students who have defined me not only as a professor, but as a woman and a person as well. So been very fortunate in where my professional career has taken me in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, that has a lot to say about you, who you are. That kind of work is, it is not for the faint of heart, you know?
No.
So what led you to studying criminology in Florida?
So I've always been a true crime junkie. I know a lot of your listeners probably understand, oh, yeah, especially if they're those middle-aged women.
Are you a murderino?
Right, I am. I love anything true crime, but I've kind of been in that mindset. I'm a little quirky and different. While my friends will tell you I'm the weird one of the group, but it brings a lot of fun when I can mix in a little bit of the macabre to the conversation. But that's always kind of been my mindset. I've been intrigued by particularly the human mind and the way in which we think and act and how all of us truly are capable of nearly any behavior, right?
Oh my God,
and
I know.
So, right? So what is it that, especially with things like homicide or sexual assault, something that is so life-changing and devastating for someone, how can people so carelessly do that to other people? And so I think that's always been a passion of mine. It started more as intrigue, like I think most people do, with the criminal themselves. Mm-hmm. But then it took one moment. I met a mother. I was working in a cold case unit. I met a mother who came in and wanted to know what had happened to her daughter's case because it had been unsolved for so many years. And the detective at the time said, oh, Ashley, I'll talk to you, right? And he pushes me outside with this poor mother who was grieving and hurting. And the moment I spoke to her, mm-hmm, it became so different to me. It was about more now the victim and their family and how these crimes impact such a broader network than what we think about, right? And the criminal no longer mattered to me. The investigation,
it's the forever ripples.
Yes, mm-hmm, yes. And the investigation didn't matter as much to me. It was more about the lived experiences of people who face trauma, and somehow are able to overcome that trauma, right? Even without things like an answer in their unsolved murder or those types of things.
Is this the only way to become involved in this path? Like, is this a niche that you made for yourself? Or who else does this?
Oh, well, a lot of us crazies that like school a lot. Anyone willing to sell their soul. Yes. Anyone willing to sell their soul to academia can do this. No, you know what? That's not even true, because while cold case homicides might be a niche that I've created, because very few scholars really do focus on one, the families of violent crimes, but specifically cold case homicide survivors. Mm-hmm. But you know, some of the bravest, most impactful human beings in the realm of work that I do are survivors themselves, who have, you know, gone through and witnessed the death of a loved one via a murder. And then they're able to say, you know what, I will not let this happen in vain. I will not let my loved one's memory be forgotten. I will not let other families suffer the way we've had to suffer. And so, to be honest, who's the expert in the area? It's not me. It's the families that I help. And to me, that's power there, right? I have a platform that I get to share stories, but these people are the stories. These people are the human beings behind those stories. And Aaron, they'll have more impact than I ever will, right? Because they know that kind of trauma and pain, and they know how to help other families not experience that, or at least, I mean, not experience the homicide, but to be able to have access to better resources and those types of things.
So how long have you been doing this specific type of work now?
Well, I started that in 2008 was when I kind of transitioned. I was in graduate school at the time. That's when I started my PhD program. So I had been in grad school since 2006, getting my master's in 2008. I started my PhD, and I had really nailed down that was going to be my path for my professional career. And then insert laughter, right? We all assume that we know how to chart out and plan the rest of our lives. And so in 2008, I kind of said, okay, this is who I'm going to be. And I started this career, not only getting my PhD and getting those first couple of academic jobs, but I really said, I'm going to be super successful in the field of academia, ready, set, go. Mm-hmm. And then insert.
As we talked about, God has the craziest sense of humor.
Oh, God bless him. Right.
That is, unfortunately, it is part of your story. You have experienced grief of your own that connected to your work. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Cut me off if it goes too long.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
I will hold space for this as long as it takes.
Oh, I love it. Okay. So let me talk about first rejoice, you know, beautiful things that have happened in my life.
Please, because, yes.
Yes. Because I think when we do suffer trauma and heartbreak, I think that becomes the narrative of our story. And I want to make sure that the joy and the blessings that come with, right, the cost of admission to life, that mm-hmm. when you love, you lose. Yeah. And when you try, you fail sometimes. And so I'm going to talk about the heartbreak, but I want to make sure the beauty's in there too. So let me sprinkle. God.
Thank yeah. you for yes. that.
I'm going to sprinkle some beauty first.
I agree, and then, because this does not define you. Just because right. it is a defining moment in your right. life, it is not the only moment.
Right.
Yeah. So right. Good framing.
Yes, of course. So as I'm finishing my PhD, right, and I'm starting this new kind of chapter of my life as an academic, I met the most incredible human being in the world. His name was Buddy Wellman, and I met him and went on my first date with him in April 30th, 2010. And I told him very quickly after, you do not want to marry me. You do not want to be with me because I have to leave. I've got to move for my job, right? I'm about to graduate with my PhD. I'm going to have to move. You have your dream job.
Where were you planning on moving?
I didn't know. So with academia, here's the crazy thing. I just knew I couldn't work there. In academia, you're not able to work at the institution you get your PhD from, at least not right away, right? They want to make sure that they're getting new blood into the institution, those types of things. So I knew that I was going to have to put in for any job I was willing to take. And then it's kind of like roulette, right? You just do not know where you're going.
Okay.
So that's the joy of academics. So so I knew I was just going to have to move. And he was so happy in his job. But he said, that's just part of life, right? So he said, I'm going to tag along for the ride if you're willing to keep me. So 1 year later, on April 30th, 2011, wow. we actually got, yeah, exactly 1 year later, we got married right as I was getting my PhD. And we started kind of that path together of from institution to institution and trying to pursue this life of happiness. We would have a beautiful baby girl in 2014. Her name is Reagan. Mm-hmm. And she's now six. And then in 2016, we decided we're going to start trying for a second baby. And I, you know, you hear all the time about how difficult it can be the older you get to have a kid, but it had been so easy for us to have Reagan that we were naive and somewhat stupid in thinking, okay, it's still going to be easy again.
Optimistic.
That's right. And I had from 2016 to 2018, I would suffer 4 back-to-back-to-back miscarriages. Mm-hmm. And it took me to a really dark place to where I remember Buddy telling me, Ashley, I want my wife back, right? I just want my happy wife back. And, you know, I said, I don't know how to get her back because I don't feel like the mother I want to be. I, you know, am betrayed by my body, all of these things. And work at the time was not bringing me joy either. I had reached tenure, which is supposed to, you know, celebrate the
that's the pinnacle. Goal.
Oh, that's it, right? Mm-hmm. I had gotten it. Very little joy that is supposed to follow with that. And so we stepped back and we said, what is the purpose of life? And it's to be happy. So together we decided, let's put in for a couple other jobs and see what happens. And that would take us to Texas, where I am now. Mm-hmm. And we took a risk. I stepped way down in my career, from an associate professor down to an instructor, with the promise of kind of a path where I was going to make it back, right, to this tenure track position. Mm-hmm. And that was okay because I was sacrificing for my family. And so we got to Texas, and the day before I started school in 2018, I heard glass shatter downstairs, and I ran down the stairs to find my husband lying in the hallway. He was seizing and he couldn't breathe. And I didn't know what was happening. All I knew to do was grab the phone and call 911. And so I run upstairs, grab the phone, and I do not do well under pressure, much less traumatic pressure. So I run back down and all I could do was just scream, you know, like, help me, help me. And in the meantime, my 4-year-old has come around the corner and sees her dad lying in the hallway. Mm-hmm. And she's just screaming to me, you know, please save my dad, please save my dad. So the fire truck and the ambulance come and they tell me that he's going to be okay because he has a heartbeat. And as long as they can keep his heartbeat, right, they'll figure out what's wrong with him and he's going to be all right. And so at first I really thought, okay, I need to figure out what I'm going to say to him when he wakes up. Like, I had a very optimistic outlook that he's going
to
be okay.
You have to.
Absolutely. Right. And so I was able to start calming down until I saw another fire truck come up, and the men who jumped out, they looked nervous and upset, and they ran into the house, and I kept screaming, does he have a heartbeat? Does he have a heartbeat? And no one would answer me. And so I finally grabbed one of their shirts and I said, does he have a heartbeat? Yes or no? And they said, he does not. And so I think that was the first moment that I thought, oh my God, it may not be okay. Mm-hmm. I followed the ambulance to the hospital. My daughter had been picked up by an individual that we knew here. And I watched for 60 minutes while they tried to resuscitate him. And they were able to get him back with CPR 4 times. His heart's restarted 4 times.
Wow.
But by the end of the time they lost him the 4th time, the doctor screamed out, it was 4:30. She screamed out, Ashley, stop. And I panicked. I was like, what are you talking about? Stop. Like, he needs to hear my voice, right? I need to cheerlead him because he's got to live. Mm-hmm. And she told me to stop because if he came back, he was going to be brain dead. And I knew, right, from our talks, I knew that that was not something he was willing to do. Mm. And so, like, that was not a life that he wanted. And so I told her, you know, stop. And then it literally felt like my world just fell out from underneath me. I remember I could barely stand up. I was screaming, like, where are you going to take his body? Like, what are you doing with him? Mm-hmm. And
well, the entire reality just
yes.
broke.
Yes. And you don't know, there's no idea of what you're really supposed to be doing, right? Yeah. Like, it really became a point where I got to kiss him goodbye for a few minutes. And then it was kind of like, just go home. I mean, it was so bizarre. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. They tell you that your loved one's deceased and then kind of like, okay, let us know when you're ready to go home. And so for me, the added trauma was that I couldn't wrap my head around the reality of my best friend being dead, right? And my rock being dead, because I'm type A, I'm way hyper, I worry about everything. And Buddy was so calm and cool, such a good dad, right? Everything just was easy.
It was the balance that you brought.
Yes. Oh my God, the yin and the yang of just from heaven, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm grieving this reality that I can't get my head around, that he's not here. And then I have a 4-year-old whose best friend is also dead. So I have the added trauma of having to be a mother to a grieving baby. Mm-hmm. So for me, right, I've lost kind of my definition of motherhood, right, with the miscarriages. I've lost who I was as a wife, But lo and behold, I'm like, I know who I am as a careered woman, right?
Yeah.
I know who I am. I don't know, if, you know, like where we sit back and we're like, who am I? Okay, but when you introduce yourself, oh, I'm a professor, oh, yeah. I'm a scholar. You know, that's who I am. And so for the next year, I was so blessed. I got a bereavement leave for a couple months. I had amazing people rallying around me, around the community. And I went back to work and I fought, Aaron. I fought to say, look, I'm going to be super successful in spite of, right, what has happened to me. And so I was-
If anyone's equipped, it would yes, be you.
I got this, right? I got this. And Aaron, I was using all of the tools to try to heal that I had given my families. So things like, you know, get help professionally because, you know, it's really hard to grieve on your own. Make sure you're being vulnerable with your, not only yourself, but your family too, right? And making sure Reagan could see me grieve, those types of things. So as I'm literally trying to manage health and lifestyles and things like this, I'm also fighting to be, right, great at my job.
Wow.
And the job I had been told I would get, right, comes available. And I thought, my God, this is the last piece of the puzzle that we had moved our family to Texas for. This is it. And I've got to check off, right? I got my daughter into the school we wanted. I got the home we wanted. All of these things by myself without Buddy here, right? And so the last thing was I was going to get this job to have security and control of my career for my daughter. And I had no concept of what was happening behind the scenes because I think... when you grieve, people around you, right, struggle to keep up with the energy that's needed to support someone who's grieving, right? Absolutely. Because it's messy and it's hard and it takes a lot as a support person too. Mm-hmm. And so I think some of these people had kind of burned out the favors and the energy they were willing to spend with me. But at work, they actually... a small group of my colleagues prevented me from being considered for this job. Not, I didn't get it. I wasn't considered for it.
It's terrible.
Yes. And so then, you know, the grief started all over again. This year battle I had had to get healthy kind of felt like, oh my God, it got ripped out. You know, my job now is ripped out from underneath of me. And the future that I was supposed to have here isn't there. And so the question that kept going through my head was, who am I? Like, if not this, then who am I? Now I'm nobody. Now I'm not valuable. What could I have done to be perceived as worthy or good enough or whatever? And, you know, what's ironic is that colleagues that I didn't necessarily expect to step up and be my army, right, have become like family to me and said, like, Ash, this stuff doesn't matter, right? Like, yes, maybe the perceptions and the things are not what you want them to be. Maybe the future here is not what you think it was going to be, right? Or what you thought it was going to be. But I've had angels in my corner who have every time I sit there and I say, who am I then? I'm nobody, right? My worth is gone. And I felt like I was, you know, couldn't get my feet underneath of me. I have to kind of rely on the people around me to tell me the truth and not believe the small narrative that's being said by people who don't have my best interest at heart, right? Mm-hmm. Or even worse, the things I say then about myself because of how you feel, right? You listen to the darker voices. And so that's kind of where I was for quite a while. I'd say several months I stayed in that space.
Before we move on, where do you think that voice, that inner voice comes from? What do you think that is?
The one that's not so nice to me?
Yeah, the one that's not nice. Because I know we all have it. It's a very fascinating thing that we all have, that person in the back of our head who's meaner than anyone ever else could be to me.
And meaner to yourself than we would ever be to somebody else.
Oh my
right?
God.
Or allow anyone to be spoken to, right? But we do it to ourselves so easily. Yeah. I think there's a combination of things, right? I think there's always this battle of what if I'm not good enough, right? And when we're raw and vulnerable, I have the personality that I put myself out there so much, probably too much, right? If you know me, you know me. Every part of me, right? The good, the bad, and the ugly. And sometimes that backfires. But I think there's then that fear of what if I'm not liked? And what if they don't like what they see? Do you know what I mean? And so in some ways, I think we might do that to keep ourselves protected. And like, then the stuff that is said about us is not as bad, right? Like I already felt that. So then when you say that, it's not that big of a deal. Or, you know, there's an equal fear, I think, of success that there is a failure. And so I think that, you know, especially for me, and as a type A OCD type of person, right? I'll get a thought in there. And then it's like, I almost talk myself into it being real, you know, and it takes a lot of work to undo some of those things that we say to ourselves. Yeah.
It really, really does. I know for me, we were talking right before we recorded about mantras, that life-changing, you know, like unbelievable, repeating something to yourself, instead of that negative narrative that you could just let be on repeat if you want.
Yes. I remember through utter brokenness, a couple of days after I found out I wasn't getting this interview, right? I wasn't even getting considered for this position. I remember sitting at the kitchen table sobbing, and I had ordered on Amazon a bulletin board and ink for my printer, because I was like, I've got to put up something that helps me realize, like, whatever's in my head right now and whatever I feel about myself, right, and questioning my worth and my value and, you know, what actually, I mean, how I'm going to provide for my child, like all kinds of questions. I just pushed print on my computer with a bunch of different inspirational pictures. And I'm sitting there literally like can barely see cutting these pictures out because I'm crying so hard. And I'm just sticking them on this board because I'm like, damn it, if I don't believe it right now, I'm gonna print out something that says things like, you know, maybe you're not the author of your story. Maybe, you know, or you are worthy. You're beautiful the way you are, right? You're valuable. And as corny as that sounds, that bulletin board is still hanging up behind my bedroom door, but I'm adding different things to it now than what I needed 1 year ago. Yeah.
It's what you need for that time. Yes. Absolutely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You can, that internal dialogue, if you can program it for those positive things, it works.
It does. And it gives you an energy so different, right? Because I think when my mantra to myself was, who are you then? Are you, you know, like you weren't good enough. You weren't valuable enough. What that was doing was putting me in a place where I did feel stuck and I felt helpless, right? Because I was telling myself I didn't have the ability to fix it. And I didn't have the ability to take control of life, right? And trust myself enough to kind of start rewriting what I wanted life to look like. And so I think it wasn't until a couple months later, I'd actually gone down to the courthouse and filed a small business permit and said, I don't know what I'm doing with this, right? Because I don't know how you run a small business with, while working full time and these kinds of things. But I said, I'm going to start this small business. I'm going to really refocus on creative writing, which was something that I had been doing while I was grieving, right? I had given myself permission to seek a new or revived outlet. And for me, it was creative writing.
Now, was that a passion from long back? Was it a new one? How did that one come into focus?
I think it was a buried one. I think that what I had
done. Those are the best.
Yes, right? I was, as a child, I was so creative. I love theater. I love art. My mom's a brilliant artist. You know, my dad always teases and says I got all my talents from him. I did not. My mom is so talented with artistic things. And so I've always had that. I used to tell my parents I was going to be a Broadway star, but I have.
That used to be me too.
Right? I have performance anxiety, so I cannot sing at an audition to save my life. And so I had kind of started as you get older, I think we stop believing what we're told that you can be anything you want. And that doesn't seem true anymore, particularly like I was telling you, like as you get older, I'm 36. Mm. Last year, trying to think of like, who could I be if I'm not this, right? Or if this is not going to take me where I want to go. There is no voice saying you can be anything you want, right? The older you get, that gets quieter. Mm. And so for me, I knew that I wanted to be something. I was thinking FBI was something that I really bought into. I wanted to be a federal agent. There's no creativity in that. I thought about being an attorney. There's no creativity in that. And then I got settled on this idea of, you know, graduate school and criminology. And I remember one of the first things my advisor said to me in graduate school, I was writing with her, you know, and she said, Ashley, you write so much fluff and beautiful storytelling kind of things. You've got to cut that mess out. Like it's beautiful, but you cannot write like this. Okay. You need to write very dry and very straightforward. And so that's what I've been doing for, I don't know, like the last 15 years of my life is kind of this very scientific, scholarly approach to life. And that bleeds into all perspectives. I didn't have time to be pursuing local theater or things of that nature. So a creative writing I was sitting in the condo where Buddy had just passed away. And like I said, I think grief is scary for so many people that the visits from local people slowed down tremendously. Mm-hmm. And I was alone a lot in that condo, not on the weekends. All my friends around the country will tell you I was not alone on the weekend. They flew, in and would not leave me alone.
That's
thankfully,
nice.
Wow. Thankfully. Right. But to think, you know, oh, well, she was only alone for 4 days or 5 days that week. It was so scary in that apartment because of the trauma that in the heavy, you know, visual trauma, the sounds I could hear, I could picture him passing away like every time I closed my eyes. Right. And it was so dark and heavy. And thank God I had a friend in town who would come pick me up and be like, hey, Ash, let's go get a glass of wine. Hey, Ash, let's go do this. And he had seen a picture of my daughter dancing with this little skeleton. And he said, you should, that's the coolest thing ever, is that your daughter is
like,
not
loves that skeleton.
Yes. And she's not scared of something that should be very scary. What if you just wrote for fun about your daughter and the skeleton? And I said, okay. So he said, write a kid's book. I came back to him 2 days later with a script of this book. It has morphed. But
that's
but
crazy.
Yes, a script of the book. And he started laughing and he said, I never meant to like bring me a book in a couple of days, you know? And so from there, he said, well, guess what? If you're going to write, let's write, you know? And he said, like, I have this dream of a ghost book for teens. And so we started writing on this ghost book, and I started to see color, Aaron. I don't know, as a fellow artist,
yeah,
if you know what I'm talking about,
I do.
But I had been walking through life, and it might've been 2 weeks, 3 weeks, who knows, but however long, the first 4 months of grief were a blur to me. So I can't tell you when in the process this was, but I was walking around almost on autopilot and there was no joy. There was no emotion. There was no anything. It was just like, put a smile on your face, get your daughter to school, make sure she's smiling, right? Be there to comfort her and go to bed and start over again, right? And it was, I almost think, just a conditioned thing to say, you don't have an option of lying down and staying in bed. You've got to get up and function. So the only way to do that was really like this autopilot thing. Mm-hmm. And so when I started creative writing, I ran into his office one day and I said, oh my God, I can see colors and don't think I'm crazy. But for the first time in, you know, weeks or months, I can feel color and I can feel energy,
yeah,
that I have not felt in forever. And I was standing in his office reading something I had just written, and then I would act it out for him and we would laugh. And God, the process was just so different from what I had been given permission to do before. And so, yeah, it's wild what tapping into your creativity can start to do for you.
That you have bridged the gap right there wonderfully. So let's talk about the work that you have done, the life that you had led, and where you're headed, what you're doing now. You have the book on the shelf back there behind you, My Friend Fresno. Tell us more.
Yes. Okay. So where am I going? Wherever I want, Aaron.
Yeah.
No. You know,
that's the best answer.
I think it took quarantine for me to really start looking at and stop listening to this idea of need for stability, and that, oh, Ashley, what you have right now is stable, right? In an amount of a paycheck, right? Having that be the only reason you put yourself in a toxic environment, or you allow yourself to be treated a certain way, yeah, because you need the quote stability. I've had to relearn, I don't just need stability. I need my health. And I need my happiness.
Yep.
And what I've been the last several months, I'm telling you, I had been on this path prior to the work thing. From the time Buddy passed away to the time that that happened, I literally was like, I felt like a gold medalist in the Olympics going, I am the queen of grief, right?
Yeah.
I am slaying this. I had really messy moments and many things I wish I could take back in that grief journey. But I was fighting daily, Aaron, to learn a new way to cope, a new way to provide for my daughter. And I was feeling alive again and so healthy towards this job application that I put in. And then when I didn't get that, I feel like I went so much further back, and I was like physically having the repercussions of the anxiety and the heartbreak and all of those things. And I was crying constantly and I was just exhausted. I didn't have any more to give. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I, I did this stupid thing of saying like, how much worse could it get? When in reality, I'm blessed. Yeah. I'm blessed. Even with the worst that I've experienced, I'm more blessed than a lot of people I know. So that's foolish for me to say, but I was so tired and I kept saying, well, Ash, this is all you are. And this is all you've got. Yeah. So as quarantine, you know, came up, I had no excuse but time on my hands to reach out for help and ask, you know, for a therapist to help me kind of rewire the way I viewed myself. I realized everything that we think is stable isn't, right? So yeah. Universities are closing down everywhere. People are losing their jobs. You know, the companies that have been stable for so long are falling under. And so one, you can just throw stability out the window, right? What does that even mean? And I started realizing I have to get healthy. And so I said, what if Fresno, which was kind of this fun thing I was kind of tinkering with, became more of a vessel for magic for Reagan and me to not only write this book and share this message of acceptance and love and self-worth. That's what the book's about, right? A little girl who meets this little skeleton who thinks he's too scary, too fragile to be friends with anybody, right? Yeah. And Reagan teaches him that their differences make them special and that they're better together, right? Because they're different. They're better together.
Absolutely.
I thought like, what a better time, my God, as quarantine happened, right? Our world's falling apart with social injustice and racial tension and political divide. And so I thought, whoa, this message that I've been sitting on, right, with Fresno is so perfect right now. And I think so many of us just need the hope and the positivity. So I started saying, this is not only going to just be a book that I put out for fun. I'm going to make this part of who I am and use the skills I have as a professor, as a scholar, as an advocate to push this, not just as a book to make money for my family, but as a literally a curriculum to teach little ones, right? That they're so special and that our worth and our value doesn't come from anything people are telling us. It's from within. And that the things that scare us, right? And I'm taking lessons from Fresno myself. The things that scare us are often just misunderstood, right? It's not really scary. Try it, right? Get to know it, get comfortable with the uncomfortable, and it actually becomes pretty beautiful, right? My whole transition has been that, right? And then this fight to say, I could take that and put it into elementary schools and I could still be teaching, right? Because that's, I love my students. Oh my God, I love my students so much, right? The thought of not being in teacher mode isn't in my realm, right? Not advocating for social justice. It just doesn't seem like that could not be who I am. And so what I'm learning is that these skills that we think isolate us into a vein of a career translate to so many different things. If we'll just step back and say like, that's, it's not all about just that, you know, being a professor, look at what skills I brought to the table to
do. You have to rethink how you are allowed to use the skills that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And there's such a cookie cutter, especially like in academia, right? There's such a cookie cutter vision of what success looks like and what is acceptable and what it means to be, quote, good at something. And so to break those rules and say, wait a minute, you know, there is a place for creativity. There is a place for feeling valuable and worthy and not being ashamed of those types of things, right? Celebrating mm-hmm. what makes us unique. In our work, I think is very exciting, right? Can tell, like I can even tell as I'm, I just change when I talk about what I could be doing and who I want to be, right? Mm-hmm. I want to live a purposeful life. I don't always do that right now. I'm learning, right?
You know, but that's okay. I don't think there's a way. I mean, okay, there is a way to live a non-purposeful life. Let's get that out of the way. But, you know, the kind of life that you're leading in with the passion that you have, those moments where you probably don't feel like you are, those are rest moments, and you are allowed to rest. That's something that, like, I had to teach myself throughout my whole life. I always thought I was behind. That's always what I felt. Even though I was always told, you're ahead. It was just really, I was just always in a rush. I was racing a deadline that didn't exist with anybody else. I was running in a race by myself. And it's important to remember that those moments where you rest, literally just as important as the work you're doing.
And I think that's the hardest thing that I'm fighting for now, is to say there are like precious moments now. I think we live our lives to say, when this happens, I'll be happy.
I'll be happy.
When I get this, then I'll be happy, right? And I did this again with my survivors. I wrote a paper on the fact that, is it truly the conclusion of the case that's going to bring joy? Or do we have to find the joy now, right? Mm. And hope that something else happens down the road, but be comfortable living in right now, right? Maybe without answers, maybe without all these things, but I don't do what I tell people to do, right?
It's always much easier to give the advice.
Yeah. And so I think even with right now, you know, I'm homeschooling or keeping Reagan at home online and all of these things, we've had months of quiet, and that quiet was terrifying and beautiful at the same time, because I am having to rewire the way I think and saying, you know what, Ashley, it doesn't have to be when the book's in your hand. It doesn't have to be when some book award is won. You wrote it and you sent it out. That was a need for celebration. You got a proof back. That's a need for celebration.
Yes.
You got right. And instead of sitting there being so hard on myself and saying, okay, well, when this is perfect, I'll be happy.
It'll never be perfect.
Never going to be. And as an artist, geez, I don't like that. I don't like it. I'm not.
Oh, your academic side must hate it.
I hate it.
There's no finish line with art.
No. And so I'm trying to say, you know what? I'm going to have to be 98% happy and let the world just like see 98% perfection from me, which is new. And then I'll just write books 2 and 3, right? Nice. And keep it going with imperfect perfection, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Going forward. So I'm a work in progress, just like art, you know, just like the art that I do. I think that the most powerful thing I've learned, though, is that even when things end tragically, right, or don't yes. come out the way that they're supposed to, right? I wanted a second child. I didn't get it, and I may never get that. I wanted a husband that I said, till death do us part, and that mean at 95, right? I never thought I was going to lose a healthy husband to a pulmonary embolism at 44. Never. Yeah. And then I wanted this successful, quote, you know, end quote, career, and it didn't happen, right? And so, but if I just focus on that, I forget the blessing that I have a healthy child, right?
Yeah.
And that I have a piece of Buddy Wellman forever, mm-hmm. who's next to me, and she's perfection, right? Yeah. And I forget that I had 9 gorgeous years with Buddy Wellman, where I relearned that I was worthy and valuable and perfect just the way I was. Right. And that he would have been the first one to, if I said I was going to start a circus, he would have ridden on a elephant and sat in the front row. Do you know what I mean? Like, he wouldn't have cared. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of learned that fearless belief. And then with school, right? I have met the most amazing colleagues. I've met the most amazing students. I've met the most amazing survivors. And the skills I have today that are allowing me to start to say, Ashley, the author. Right. And Ashley, yes. Right. Those all are because I had that chapter and those chapters. So that's very powerful in the darkness. And in the moments where I say, like, why me, why is this happening? This is so unfair. I go, but look at what it all brought you. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like I said, the cost of admission to living your life is that certain things end. And because it hurts so bad means it was pretty damn good and you didn't want to say goodbye. Right. So those are the things that I'm trying to put at the forefront of my mind as I move forward with Creative Ashley and giving myself permission to say, you're enough and
yeah.
you know, you're capable of anything you want to do. I got to talk to myself like I talk to my child, right? Anything you want, go do it.
The way that I think about talking to myself, getting that voice to be quiet, I put him in a rocking chair so he has to do, and I turn the volume down, and then I turn the volume up on the voice, and I talk to myself like I'm just a house plant, you know, like I'm super simple, just like, hey, Aaron, you're enough.
Yeah, you know, stop like, that mess.
Breathe.
You know what I think? I have to do the thing like in A Beautiful Mind. I don't know if you remember,
yeah.
right? Where they're like, those voices aren't real. And he's like, they're very real. They're right there. I'm just not listening to them. Right.
Yes.
And so I'm having to have all those mean voices over.
That's 100% right.
Against the wall. But I like this idea of the coaching my little house plant and loving, loving myself as a little house plant. I'm not good at keeping plants alive though, Aaron.
I'm not either.
I'm really bad.
I'm not either, but I do my best.
Yeah, so that's all we got to do is just do our best.
And something that I think that your story really touches on, a theme that I can hear in it is just because something does not last, does nothing to change how beautiful it was.
That's right.
You know, temporary existence is all of our existence. It's mm-hmm. all temporary. The only thing that is constant is change. And right. as a result, we do have these strong moments where something sort of alchemizes, you know, and literally it is, you have to find the joy in it because it is an opportunity to transform.
It doesn't have to be changed. Yeah, it doesn't have to be something that ends us and cripples us. And no, and I think, and it's okay. Not. Hey, when it feels like that, and you can literally just start wanting to break things and scream and be so angry, but then in the silence, start thinking about, could this also be permission to change? Could this be a ticket to rewrite a different part of my life I never expected, right? And I think we project or anticipate bad things have to come after bad things occur. And the reality is that when you're raw and things are, you feel broken and it's really hard, that could be the most beautiful time where things like art and, you know, the music comes and the creation comes or the vision comes of what you want to be next. So like, you know, from the ashes, we can all be these phoenixes that come up. So I think it's believing that that good will come and showing up every day and fighting for it. And whether you get it or not, right?
Yeah.
Showing up for yourself and saying, okay, put the voices aside, turn up your house plant talk. Yep.
If you're doing your best.
Yes.
Which, yes. You know, for a lot of people, just showing up is the best.
Then that's great. There's so much that's changing. It's been forced change. And change is scary and change can be messy, but it's also, I think, like you said, it's bringing out these really beautiful things, even when it's out of pain, right? And out of sadness or fear, we can create such beautiful things in that. For me, Fresno started as a way to survive Buddy's death. And then over the next year or so, it became a way to kind of heal. And then as the trauma at work started, it became a way for me. Now I had to change perspectives for that. And it said, why can't I thrive with this? Right. So like the purpose, even of the same things we're doing might start to evolve and be different.
I love that, especially in context of art. The same piece of art that you're working on will absolutely mean something different to you throughout the process. Often my favorite time with a piece of art is in the middle of creating it. It's not at the end. Like you think it would be.
No.
It's not there every time. But I always do love that middle ground because for me, that's where I find that state of flow, which is one of the big things that we talk about here. What does that mean to you? And when do you experience the state of flow?
Well, for me, God bless flow. I don't know. I'm like a hot mess break dancer. I don't know that I get flow a lot. I just break into spastic moves and go.
I think that is flow.
Okay, good. Okay. Well then I'm spastic flow is the way I do it. It's funny because it's almost like the cycle of mental health, right? Where I get these like beautiful moments of creativity and then I get into these dark ruts of like, oh my God, I cannot pick up a pen. I have nothing valuable to say. This is not smart. I shouldn't be doing this. And then, you know, 2 hours later, I could snap into something that goes, oh, by the way, I just wrote Fresno's First Christmas. That's going to be book three. I was in a really bad place one day and I said, oh, I guess I'll sit down and like look at the computer because I'm not going to write. And like 2 hours later, I wrote Fresno's First Christmas, an entire children's book. And I was calling friends and like, can I read this to you? You know, tell me if this is good because I just came up with it. Or with our ghost book, you know, I would kind of not write for 2 weeks. And then all of a sudden I would sit down and write two chapters and then want to go perform them for my co-author, right? So he could laugh and I could, you know, have him pick up and pick up the pieces. But for me, it's kind of the feast or famine thing. And that breaks a lot of the writer rules, right? I have a lot of people that say you should write every single day, right? No matter what you have to say.
Do you know how hard it is?
That's really hard.
Force creativity.
Yeah. And it's just not, to me, it's not. To me, I would rather get lost in the moment and be so proud of the magic in that moment than have to force it. As a single mom, I got a lot of other things I could be doing. So if it's not bringing me joy, I don't want to be doing it, right? And yeah. So I do enough of that every day. So my writing, I think I keep it sacred and I keep it something to me that if I'm not enjoying it right this second, I need to walk away. And I've been doing that throughout the process. I was telling you before we started recording, I got my hands on my proof of My Friend Fresno, right? The girl who dances with skeletons. And I opened it up and I got so nervous and upset. One, because I think it's real, right? It's real now.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
How scary. What are you doing?
I hope you didn't mess up, right? Because I just ordered 10,000 copies of this, right? It's like, I hope it's good. But you know, I went to this dark place of like, this is not what I thought it was going to be, and panicked as an artist because I wanted it 100% perfect. And then 2 days later, I came back to it and I opened it and I said, my God, this is beautiful. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But it took me, I think the fear and sometimes if we're forcing ourselves to evaluate our work in a time when we're not ready to evaluate our work, it can be devastating. And so I'm learning, I'm new at this. So I am learning that when I don't feel joy, put it down, right? If I'm too much in my head, put it down.
That's such a good rule.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, you're absolutely right. I mean, it really is the fear of saying goodbye to something or allowing yourself to move beyond something that you wanted so badly, right, is really terrifying. Yeah. But like you said, I mean, I witnessed the fact that life is so short and we are not guaranteed anything. And even worse, I could have been the one who passed away, right, and not gotten this life. And mm-hmm. So for me, I'm saying, why am I throwing it away sick and sad? And, you know, in letting that define who I am when I could be creating a life that's, yeah, scarier, but a lot more beautiful if I allowed myself to try it, right? So I think it is taking that risk on ourselves the same way we'd encourage our friends or our children or anything to risk and try.
That's right? A big because, one that I'm taking on myself, which is betting on yourself.
Yes.
You know, like, investing in yourself. Mm-hmm. I actually mm-hmm. understand what that means now. It even means like energetically.
That's you know, right.
Believing for yourself. And
that's right. We do so much for other people. Yeah, we do so much for other people. And like you and I were talking earlier, those voices that are so mean to us, even that, we wouldn't do that to someone else, right? So saying I'm worth being a priority. Mm-hmm. And whether you're a mother or a partner or, you know, a boss of a company or a worker at a company, you also matter, right? You don't always have to be the role to someone else, right? You also matter. When we don't put that little oxygen mask on ourselves first and we mm-hmm. don't take time to love and nurture ourselves, I think we give far less to others than we are capable of. Mm.
Oh man, that right there is like the most true thing you've said. I can just like think back to other periods in my life where I'm like, man, if I had just known that earlier.
That's all right. I think we learn these lessons when we need them most, right? I do. And I think whatever phase you were in then, when you wish you had known it, you learn something new then too, because you didn't know it, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I think I'm also trying not to say like what should have happened or what could I have done. It's just, you know what, this is where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Every chapter has served a purpose and brought joy and pain, and that's life.
Yeah, so, I don't regret any of it because it all has led mm-hmm. up to the whole sum of my life, which I'm very happy with
yes.
thus far.
Yes. I wish you could go back and erase certain things, but it's like, but then I think it is that butterfly effect, and who would have known maybe the next beautiful thing wouldn't have happened. So we're where we're supposed to be, when we're supposed to be there. But my advice to your listeners is don't be scared to say, you're right. I was where I needed to be when I needed to be there, but it's okay to step out
and
say, well, then the next chapter, I want it to go this way.
Wow. Speaking of the next chapter, what is the next chapter for My Friend Fresno, the girl who dances with skeletons? What's happening? When well, can I have my own copy?
Oh my goodness. You can pre-order your copy right now. Yes.
Awesome.
And so you can actually pre-order it now. And you can go to the website, www.myfriendfresno.com. And you'll be able to pre-order through October. I'm going to have the book in hand in October, which means I'm going to start sending those out. So nice. You'll be having Fresno on his way to you. There's a plush doll. There's puzzles. There's the book itself. It's a beautiful book. Let me shout out. You want to talk about artists? Let me shout out about my illustrator, Zach Kincaid. If you know Thomas Kincaid, the painter of light,
yeah.
It is his nephew.
How's and Zach spelled? Is it with a K or not?
No. So he's Zachary, but he's just Z-A-C.
Perfect.
Yep. So ZachKincaidArt.com too, wow. If you want to look at his amazing thing.
That's crazy.
But Zach literally told me as we started this project, he said, I'm not an illustrator. So I don't really know like if I should be doing a children's book. And he said, I'm not an illustrator. And I said, I know that. You're an artist. And when you open up this book, Aaron, it is picture after picture that's utter art. It's beautiful. And so Zach is just this creative genius. He took my words, which I hope are as good as his drawings.
Well, no, they go together.
Yes. And so, and he took them and he brought Fresno to life. And there's so much emotion and joy that he took from the story and brought into those pictures that I think adults and kids alike will really enjoy. And I would encourage any parent to buy My Friend Fresno because of the conversations he starts, yeah. Right? And talking to your children about people and things and religions who are different than you, but that holds so much beauty if we would just stop being scared of things that are different than us, right? If Reagan had been scared of Fresno at age 2, she never would have adopted her little skeleton best friend who's been such a beautiful part of our lives. So yes, jump onto that website, www.myfriendfresno.com. You can pre-order Fresno through October. He'll ship out in October.
Wow.
And on that site, there's also so many other fun things like pictures of our fans with their little plush doll and different activity sheets for parents and kids. So we've tried to make it a whole experience so that people can join the adventure with us.
It's a real resource that you're creating, you know, to open up dialogue about honest to God things that actually matter to talk to your child about.
Mm-hmm. At the very last page of the book, I'm going to spoil it for your listeners. The very last page of the book says that, you know, Fresno started to love himself. And I must admit, I've learned a lot from Fresno too. And then on the last page, it says, he taught me it's great just being yourself. And it doesn't matter if we come from the same type of family, look the same, or like the same things. Sometimes our greatest friends are the ones we least expect. Make no bones about it.
Well, that's lovely.
Yeah, so it's just sweet. It's just a sweet story. No crying, Aaron. Aaron's crying for all of his
listeners.
It's
like a nice cry,
though. He's so sweet.
It's like a nice cry. I'm not even sad. It's just nice.
You and Fresno would be good friends because Fresno's just as sensitive and just as sweet. But no, it is. It is. I think and it's timely, and I think it's timely for us. Yeah. You know, as even adults, I think it's so timely to say, stop being afraid of all things, right? Taking a chance on yourself. Stop being afraid of people who are different. Stop being afraid to, you know, partner with things that scared you in the past, right? And let's make the world a better place together.
Yeah, the leaving room for fear leaves room for just all the other negative things that it can spurn. So there is no sense in having fear for someone or something just because it is different than you.
Yes. And if you do have fear, do it scared, right?
Yeah.
So yeah,
do it anyway.
Do it anyway. Just jump. That's right.
And what's amazing about it is you won't be afraid after you've done it.
Right.
You know, like,
and you'll say, wow, that, you know, I should have done this earlier. I should have, you know, tried this sooner. And I'm glad that I did.
So before we move into our final section of things, Ashley, I'm just wondering, is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners or, I don't know, anything else that we haven't covered that you would like to?
I guess just reminding people that be okay, you know, listening to and being in the darkness and remembering that the sun's going to come up again, right? And yep. and realize that as bad as it seems right now, if you didn't fight to see the sun the next morning, right, you will never know the amazing beauty that the next day could bring. And so for me, it's always been about, yes, is this so unfair? Is this so heartbreaking? Is this so devastating? But I say, God bless. I want to live and fight for this to change. And I want to have a beautiful, magical life. And so I think even when it feels like we're not making progress on that journey, right? Mm-hmm. If you keep that goal in mind, mm-hmm. I think it makes life so much, you know, so much better. Just saying, yeah. you know, maybe tomorrow it's going to get better if I keep trying. And so I'm just keep fighting.
Life's long, never give up.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's a long roller coaster and you're on it. So try to have some fun.
That's right. I hope that a cool flip comes up or something.
Because surely it is coming. So we're going to move into the final section of the podcast, a section I like to call Passions Lately. Oh.
I love it.
So quite simply, Ashley, what are you passionate about lately? What is something that has been doing it for you? And it can be literally anything.
Can it be reality television?
100%, because mine's reality television. Which one's yours?
Okay, everything, because we're in quarantine. I've run out of excitement, okay? So anything that's like interior design, art competitions, you know, glass blowing competitions.
Have you seen that one, Making It?
Yes.
One of my all-time favorites, so because I love Amy Poehler.
So good.
Yeah, that one's a really good one.
Yep. So I've been watching anything artistic, anything that's kind of a challenge. One, I pretend like it's educational for Reagan. So I let her watch it with me just because I really want to watch it. So
I love that.
She's learning like glass blowing or interior design or fashion design or anything that we can get our hands on. We just started the Eco Challenge Fiji on Amazon Prime.
Nice.
And I don't work for them, I promise. No, I'm kidding. But it's about the world's toughest race. And again, all of these reality shows, especially the artistically driven ones, mm-hmm. it's not even so much about what they're creating, it's watching them create and hearing their stories and hearing the times that I can relate with these people that are saying, you know, like, oh, you know, I did this after my career fell apart. I did this after, you know, my mother passed away and I wanted to honor her this way. And all the stories of struggle. And then you look at these beautiful pieces of art that they're contributing to the world around them, you know, and they're chasing a dream. That means they'll say like, oh, I gave up my corporate job. I used to work for a Fortune 500 company and I gave it up. I went back to school to be a seamstress and here I go. Right. And it's those kinds of stories. It's the human stories within these shows that just fascinate me. So I also just, you know, I need to fill my time. So
yeah. And you know what? Sometimes you just need to relax. You need something that's just not that complex to watch. Yes.
I've actually stepped away from my true crime documentaries. You would be disturbed maybe, because I used to 24/7 watch Investigation Discovery or
I love that.
Some kind of true crime thing. And I wasn't sleeping. And one of my friends reached out and he said, Ash, like what were you doing last night? I said, I don't know. I was up till 4 a.m. And then he said, well, what did you do in that time? And I said, well, I watched Unsolved Mysteries. And then I watched this 2020 homicide special. And he went, yeah, I think we're going to need to switch to lighthearted.
You know, I have stopped watching that stuff late at night very recently as well. For the first time, my partner and I are like loving the Golden Girls.
Yes.
Everybody else always has.
I also like RuPaul's Drag Race. That's my favorite. I'm very sad that there's not a season right now. I just bought All Stars.
Well, there is Canada's Drag Race.
What?
You don't know about Canada's
Drag Race? I don't. I need to know about Canada's
Drag Race. Well, there's plenty that you're going to love. There is more RuPaul's Drag Race happening currently.
Right now. Aaron, hook me up.
You can watch Canada's Drag Race on the Crave app every Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah. Oh, I'm in. I'm so in. And I'll tell you, just like Rue says, if you don't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else? Right. What's... So I love.
Yes. Amen.
Oh, I cannot wait. I cannot wait. And one day I want to meet RuPaul so badly. And I can.
Me too.
And I want to be just, did you see the celebrity version where they had men and women, you know, female celebrities come in? I was like, I want to be done in drag and learn about my self-worth, right? Because that's what drag's about, is just finding beauty and loving yourself. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh my God, where do I sign up? Do they have these schools in the country?
I don't know. Well,
Aaron, let's find it. We'll go together.
There are tons of drag queens out there who do these personal lessons.
Well, sign me up.
What is your social media, or how can people keep up with your work? Again, yes. Just say those things for everybody one more time.
Sure. So if you guys want to follow our adventure, we're on Fresno, and you know, myself and my daughter, we're on the adventure on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We're at My Friend Fresno. And then if you want to pre-order your book or play around, we are on our website, www.myfriendfresno.com. And if you want to know more about the Ashley Wellman,
yes,
my website is www.ashleywellman.com.
Yeah. I've done research on that website of you, and it's fascinating. You are such a amazingly interesting person to me. Like,
thank you.
Your interests are just like so cool.
it's been a beautiful journey. And it's funny because when you jump on that site, you'll see Ashley the academic and Ashley the author, because it was funny. I said, like, oh my goodness, you know, who am I if I'm not this? And I said, well, all of that doesn't go anywhere. I'm still Ashley Wellman the scholar. And I'm going to be Ashley Wellman the author. And those two things so beautifully marry, even though I never knew that. So I mean, it's very cool jumping on there.
Mm-hmm. And then our final question for the pod. What is the most recent thing that has happened to you that has made you purely happy?
That has made me purely happy.
Yep.
Why is that? That's a hard question.
I know it is. That's why it's last.
Okay, good. I was like, oh no, do people struggle with this question?
A lot of times they do, and that's okay. Let me see if I can think of one.
Well, purely happy.
Mine was just like, I've had a chronic issue that I've been suffering with. I was making a doctor's appointment, and there was a cancellation. So I got to go into the doctor for something that was necessary 5 days early. So
I have one super simple, again, involves sitting on the couch, because clearly that's my new thing. So The Greatest Showman was a movie that guided buddies in my move to Texas. We had said, like, let's trust each other enough to just throw it all to the wind. I stepped down from the secure position you had. Let's try it. And as long as we're together, right, we can envision this world of magic together, right? And so that really, literally the soundtrack was something that we listened to, like driving down and, you know, this and that. And so when he passed away, it was a love-hate kind of thing with that music and that show, because it was so us. And so it was too raw for me to watch a lot of times. And just the other day, it just came out on Disney Plus. Yeah. My daughter wanted to watch it because she loves the music. And we sat there and snuggled under a blanket, watched the movie, and it was pure happiness. There was no sadness, you know, like, because the mixed feelings. I was in the grocery store a week after he passed away, and This Is Me was playing. And I was like, oh no, right? And it made me feel safe and heartbroken. And so, like, sometimes I avoid things like that. And I said, you know what, let's embrace it and watch it together. And it was that moment of just the whole movie singing together and being joyful in it. It was great. And it was like, okay, so he's up there singing too, and, like, you know, laughing at us, and or at least he's trying to sing. He had a terrible voice, and he would tell you.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that shift and starting to see that, you know, I don't always have to live my life heartbroken. I just get to celebrate that I had him and that I have his little girl, and that, you know, life, he's not coming back. So, you know, life has to get beautiful again, and I get to live again. And I was left here. You know what I mean? So those moments where you just feel happy feels so great when you've been through trauma and tragedy, right? Where you just feel happy. So that was a good question.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Thanks. Aaron, literally the moment you and I spoke months ago, right? Yeah. Or a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
It's just even moments like this where you just get to connect with another human about real life and encourage each other, good, bad, ugly.
Yep.
I appreciate what you do because I think your listeners are very fortunate, and I'm glad that I just got a piece of your heart for the last hour.
That's so sweet. That's a perfect place to end things because I'm going to cry again.
I love you, Aaron.
I love you too, Ashley. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me on Eye to Eye today, Dr. Ashley Wellman. And thank you, listeners, for being here with us. Now go outside. We'll be here and gayer when you get back.
This episode of Eye to Eye was edited by Dylan Newman and the theme song written and performed by Emily Easley. Make sure to rate and subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy podcasts today.